angel dolls and Christmas letters, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Writers Jerry Bledsoe and Lee Smith are here to read from and talk about their new books, The Angel Doll and The Christmas Letters. First on the program this week, Lee Smith.
I just know that Granddaddy will shoot off the gun on Christmas morning, that you will cook a hen for dinner, Mama. Daddy will make the eggnog, and Great Aunt Lydia will give everybody those awful-looking crocheted placemats that she's been making for years and years. It makes me laugh to think about them. I send a special hug to the little twins and love to Daddy and to everybody. I trust you are all well and will have a fine holiday and that you miss me too, at least a little. And think about me down here in North Carolina, so far from home. Oh, now I'm crying again. But I've made my bed and I will lie in it the way I was taught. You may rest assured of that. I will do you proud. Bill writes that it is real hot in New Guinea, and that he has bought some little carved wooden animals from the natives for our Mary, and that he loves me. I know this is true, though it fills me with fear, too, for Bill does not really know me, nor I him. Sometimes I wonder if it is possible for any person to know any other, I mean to really know them. Often I sit in this rocking chair by my little round window, nursing Mary, and looking out across the big, slow Neuse River at the lights of town twinkling so far away. And I feel lonesome beyond words. But I will put my faith in God and trust Him to take good care of me and my baby while we all wait for sweet Bill to come home. So Happy New Year 1945 from your loving, loving Bertie. P.S. This is just about the only thing I can get Bill's mother to eat, so I try to make it as often as I can, in spite of rationing. Bertie's boiled custard. 3 eggs, 1/2 cup sugar, 3 cups milk, 1/2 teaspoon vanilla. Beat eggs, add sugar and milk, cook in double boiler until mixture will coat a silver spoon.
Writer Lee Smith. With the publication of 9 novels and 2 collections of stories, she's attracted a worldwide following devoted to her writing because of its revealing insights into the lives of women, especially women in the American South. In her new book, The Christmas Letters, Lee Smith opens another chapter in this exchange. For inspiration, she looked back to all the Christmas letters she ever received. The result is a novella at once vivid and funny, familiar and gossipy, occasionally sad but always unfiltered, a kind of seasonal view of the American family over the past 50 years. With another excerpt from The Christmas Letters, here again is Lee Smith.
Well, I'll quit running on and on and tell you now about Sandy's and my first Christmas dinner together yesterday. It was a riot. We had a baked hen, which barely fit in my oven. I'm trying, though, Mama. An oyster casserole, which did not work out because I used smoked oysters instead of the real other kind, which I guess you're supposed to use. I had bought these flat little square cans of oysters at the Piggly Wiggly. They were very expensive and blew my whole food budget for the week, but I thought you had to have oyster casserole on Christmas, Mama. I thought it was the law. Well, it looked okay, the cracker crumbs having formed a nice golden crust, just the way they are supposed to. But the minute I bit into it, I knew something was the matter. But Sandy did not even know the difference because he had never tasted oysters before anyway. Luckily, Sandy will eat anything, and he thought it was delicious. We ate Christmas dinner on the floor, since we don't have a table yet. Though Sandy's going to build us one soon, he can build anything if he can get off from work long enough to do it. While little Andrew slept on his blanket right beside us, and when we got up to do the dishes, we saw it had started to snow. So we bundled poor little sleepy Andrew up in that red snowsuit you sent, Mama, and took him out in his first snowfall ever, which was coming down so thick and fast at first that we couldn't even see beyond our little row of trailers to the street. The street light made a perfect cone of light, full of whirling flakes, as we stood beneath it and stuck our tongues out to catch the flakes and tried to make Andrew stick his little tongue out too. How sweet and cold those snowflakes were melting on our tongues, I will never forget it.
Let's talk about three generations of Southern women and the story that you're telling here in The Christmas Letters. How did this book come to be? How did you put it together?
Well, when my mother died, one of the main things that I inherited is her big box of recipes. And I was spending, and she also had her mother's recipes.
Right.
They were all wonderful cooks. And of course, I have my recipes. And I was looking at all these together one day, and I was thinking, gee, you know, we could almost tell the story of our lives in recipes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very easily, because they tell so much about who we are, you know, as people and as the culture and how we live our lives. Is, in fact, one of my main characters in The Christmas Letter says, Mary, the middle one.
Mary Pickett.
Mary says, at some point, she says, I feel as if I've written out my life story in recipes.
That's right.
The Cool Whip and mushroom soup years. Remember those?
You bet.
The hibachi and fondue period. Then the quiche and crepes phase. And now it's these salsa years. And so I wanted to do something with recipes, and then always, all my life, I have saved Christmas letters. I am fascinated with these letters that people send us every Christmas,
right.
And I usually write one myself. And so the first letter is written by Bertie, who is spending her first Christmas ever away from her own family up in West Virginia because she's been swept off her feet by a young man. She's married him, and then boom, he's off in the war. He's
right.
off in the Philippines, 1944, mm-hmm. and so she's having a baby alone and living with his parents, feeling very homesick for West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And very alone in the world. Of course, coincidentally, this was my mother's situation in 1944. I was born in 1944, and my mother was living with my father's parents and feeling, I think, probably much the same way. And so the letters are a portrait of a time and place in America, I think.
You call it a different world.
The
worlds are just so, the transitions that we have gone through.
The transitions we have gone through. Particularly, I think, the transitions that women have gone through in the ways in which we expect to live our lives and the way we live them and the world, you know, as we know it, as my mother knew it, is so radically different from the world that I've lived in, which is so radically different from my daughter Amity's world. So it's a whole interesting thing. So then my next character is Mary.
This is the daughter of Bertie.
Mary, Bertie's daughter,
right.
who takes up in 1967 and writes her own letters. And she is married, living in a trailer in Raleigh with
Sandy
a new baby.
Copeland, that's her
Mrs.
name.
Mrs. Sandy Copeland, which she is very proud of.
She goes through a progression of houses.
Oh, yeah. And again, you know, you can tell the story of our lives in real estate. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to think about who we are.
Right.
And then we go, of course, the last letter writer is Mary's daughter, Melanie.
Uh-huh.
And it just is a fascinating way, I think, to think about who we are as a culture, who we are as women, and as families. Because, you know, each Christmas letter is always the story not only of the letter writer, but of the whole family.
And the whole culture. Could
involved.
could these letters have been written anywhere but the South, Lee? This isn't necessarily a particular
commentary on the South. It's not really a Southern. I
don't think
it's necessarily a Southern a Southern novel.
Right.
It, you know, it happens to be set in the South because that's the only place I've ever been. But I think it's more American. I think this is sort of the story of, you know, women in America, American marriage, and what's happened to, you know, it's so interesting because we touch on issues of faith and child rearing.
Resiliency.
And marriage.
How you
and
bounce
resilience
back.
And, you know, patriotism and community versus private life and, you know, individual concerns and, you know, just the things that we deal with.
And yet you tie all of this to this wonderful, palpable sense of a particular place and landscape. Let me throw a couple of particulars at you here. You talk about front porches. You talk about Birdie's lunchroom. You talk about, family values, but perhaps in a really concrete sense. We're looking at the small review. Here, is this Mary as a kid?
Mary as a child.
Taking note of her life and the way it's unfolding. Yeah. Now, is that Lee Smith at work, too?
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Yeah. Telling us how you got to be a writer.
Yeah, when I was a little girl, I published a little neighborhood newspaper named The Small Review. So now I've given it to Mary.
Did you ever work in a lunch counter? How did you get a sense?
No, but my father ran his dime store in Grundy, Virginia for 50 years until his death. And so I wanted to get in something of the family business. And so I have Birdie and her husband running a dime store and Birdie running the lunch counter in the dime store. For years and years and years.
Is this a book about women winning or losing or surviving? How would you characterize
Lord,
it?
Lord, I don't know.
It's just living their lives.
It's just living
huh?
your life, you know, doing the best you can, I guess. And it's, you know, it's got some tragic events and, you know, irreparable losses and changes and things that happen in it. I'll tell you another inspiration that I had, Wayne, for writing it. I went to a lecture by Mary Catherine Bateson, the anthropologist,
right.
And she was talking about the difficulty of writing women's lives.
This is the daughter of Margaret Mead, isn't
it? That's right. Yeah. That's right, daughter of Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson. And she's talking about, in the narrative work she has done, how difficult it often is to write women's lives. Because our lives often seem so discontinuous. And so finally, she said, she began to realize that instead of thinking in terms of events and years and dates and successes and things that one would mark down, she began to listen differently. She began to listen for, instead of the big things, for the small things, the threads that continue from... you know, from passage to passage, from generation to generation. And I think that was what helped me with writing this, because each woman of each generation here, Birdie and Mary and Melanie, they have this tradition of the Christmas letter
right.
and the tradition of the recipe at the end. And so this is the thread that follows these very discontinuous and different lives, really, in the same family.
This is the way we get from Mrs. Goodwillie's Bible cake to taco salads, and I don't know if you throw any sushi at us at the end of the book, but I mean, those are apparently disconnected kinds of elements in this
reflecting
book.
Reflecting totally different kinds of lives, but yet that's the thread, you know, the notion of nurturing. Of feeding, you know, and of course when we sit down together, we're feeding our souls always right. as well as just our bodies. And so it's that little thread that continues through.
Now, the book has, again, Lee Smith, it's called The Christmas Letters. It is, at one level, a recounting of family events. At another level, there's a real dark side to what's going on here, the kind of commentary on modern marriage. Should I make of you a kind of an optimist, a pessimist? You say that the difficulty...
I think I'm a realist.
Well, the difficulty is living in between in America. Isn't that how you put it in this book?
Yeah,
is finding a negotiable pathway here? How about
that's this? That's right. And in the book, one of the things that we see disintegrating is modern marriage. I mean, Birdie's marriage was founded on values that no longer obtain
right.
in her daughter's life. And so Mary does go through a very difficult divorce and almost has to refashion herself. In fact, there's a couple of years there, as she says, when she writes no Christmas letter at all. Because she just can't, you know, she can't imagine her new self. I mean, she can't be the self that wrote those letters.
And yet we have a very American phenomenon going on, the reinvention of oneself.
Right. We have the reinvention of oneself. And eventually she does write a Christmas letter. And this one is very different, though. This one is sent only to her sister and other close women friends.
Right.
And for the first time, she's just telling it all. You know, we don't have to read between the lines. It's this enormously long Christmas letter giving us, in fact, a revisionist view of all those other letters that she's written before. And this interests me so much, the idea that there may be two complete stories about anything.
Parallel lives.
Parallel, and that they are both true. And so when Mary is going back, she was saying, well, you know, there with that trailer in Raleigh with Sandy, you know, I was really happy. That was true.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also true that I was a desperately lonely, unhappy girl, terrified of being a mother, terrified of my baby who had colic. And that was true, too. And just the notion that we can be parallel people like that. So it just interests me. I think writing interests me, Wayne. And it interests me, you know, because every time we write something down, we create a narrative.
Right.
We present a certain story, and then that's who we are. But we could be somebody else just as easily if we told another story. So I'm playing with all this.
Lee Smith is the author of The Christmas Letters, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Lee Smith's other books include Fair and Tender Ladies, Family Linen, Oral History, and The Devil's Dream. Lee Smith is a winner of a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award. To support her writing and to maintain her commitment to social involvement in Knott County, Kentucky. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more season's greetings. Writer Jerry Bledsoe is here to read from and talk about his new book, The Angel Doll.
Thomasville ushered in Christmas each year with a big parade down Main Street that always featured Miss America. Don't ask me how my little town managed that. And ended with Santa Claus sitting high in a little red sleigh pulled by 8 papier-mâché reindeer. This year, the Santa float was towed by a new tractor from the Ford place, driven by a dour man in a toboggan with a cigarette dangling from his lips. Santa tossed handsful of hard candies wrapped in cellophane to children along the way. He was tailed by a police car with a dome light flashing and a gang of boys scrambling madly for the goodies. Whitey and I both ended up with our pockets stuffed. I love the Christmas season better than any other. I couldn't get enough of the festive lights that were strung across downtown streets, the wreaths and candy canes that draped every light post, the animated Christmas scenes in the windows at Belk's department store, the sugar cookies in the shapes of bells and Christmas trees at Tasty Bakery, the notices in the newspaper of how many more shopping days were left. There was a palpable air of excitement, especially on Saturdays, when the downtown stores filled with shoppers and Christmas carols rent the air, even on the sidewalks. I had already decided what I was buying everybody that year with the money I'd saved. For my daddy, a fishing tackle box. For my mother, a bottle of Evening in Paris perfume. A sales clerk at McClellan's Five and Dime had sprayed some on my wrist, and never had I smelled anything so sweet and wonderful. For my brother Larry, who was 2.5 years younger, a football. For my baby brother Phil, a late arrival, who was just 18 months old, a toy dump truck. Whitey was with me when I exhausted my savings with the purchase of the dump truck. What are you getting for Sandy? I asked him. I don't know, he said. She wants an angel doll, but I can't find one. In the coming days, Whitey and I prowled every store in Thomasville, searching for an angel doll. We found angel figurines, angel ornaments, framed cheap prints of angels, but no angel dolls. And no clerk in any store could recall ever seeing one. We couldn't even find one in the Fat Sears and Roebuck catalog that my mother kept at our house. Still, Whitey remained determined. One way or another, he vowed, he would get Sandy an angel doll.
Writer Jerry Bledsoe. His new book is The Angel Doll. The time is the early 1950s. The place, Thomasville, North Carolina.
On a Thursday afternoon, nearly 3 weeks before Christmas, Whitey and I were on our way to the Tribune building to pick up our papers when he suddenly stopped in front of McClellan's Five and Dime and stood staring at the display window. When I looked to see what had grabbed his attention and was holding him so transfixed, I saw the angel doll for the first time. But she wasn't an angel then. She was standing amidst a group of dolls, the biggest and prettiest of the bunch. She was wearing a frilly pink dress, 2 pink ribbons in her blonde hair, and pink fringed socks with her white shoes. A small pink and white purse was fastened to one wrist. I wonder if somebody could take a regular doll and make it into an angel, Whitey said. I bet Billy's mom could, I told him. She's got an electric sewing machine. She makes all kinds of things. That planted the seed in Whitey's brain, and it blossomed immediately. By the time we got to the Tribune office, he had decided that we should go and talk with Mrs. Barnes as soon as we finished our route. And that we did. Whitey explained it all in an excited voice, then stood waiting anxiously for an answer as Billy's mom thought about it. "I don't see why we couldn't do it," she finally said. "The only problem would be the wings and the halo. But I probably could fashion those from wire. I've got some material here that would be fine for the gown, for covering the wings too. I just need some sequins or something to pretty it up." "What would you charge me?" Whitey asked. "Why, honey, I wouldn't charge a thing in the world." "I want to pay," Whitey put in quickly and firmly. "Okay, well, we can work that out." Mrs. Barnes decided that it might be better for her to go and look at the doll before Whitey bought it, just to see what problems she might encounter. She thought that she could do it the next morning while we were in school. As soon as school was out on Friday, Whitey and I headed for Billy's house. Mrs. Barnes must have seen us coming, for she greeted us at the door. "Did you get to go see the doll?" Whitey asked. "I sure did, honey," she said. "And she's going to make a beautiful angel."
Jerry Bledsoe, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about the angel doll. What happens in this marvelous little story?
This is a little story set in Thomasville, North Carolina, where I grew up in 1951 during the great polio epidemic. And it's about two little boys who share a paper route, which they have to deliver on foot, and these heavy papers in a canvas bag across their little frail shoulders. And one of these boys has a little sister who has had polio, and she is fascinated with angels, and she loves this little book called The Littlest Angel.
This is Charles Taswell, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It came out 50 years ago, in fact, this fall, and she decides that she wants an angel doll for Christmas.
We have some autobiography at work.
Much of it, most of it. It's really the story of the year I became 10, and when I was longing so deeply for a bicycle.
And the little boy gets a bicycle in this.
He does get that. Uh-huh. But this story was inspired really by the death of a young girl who was in my Sunday school class at First Methodist Church in Thomasville. Uh-huh. She was a little red-haired, freckled girl who often sat beside me, and she just came down with polio and just died. It was my first brush with death. And
who is the angel doll of the title? Is it the doll itself that you write about, or is it little Sandy, the little girl who's ill?
Yeah, it's both. But there is an actual angel doll that comes about as a result of these boys' quest.
Have you really got one that you take down every Christmas and put out?
Oh yeah.
Looks a lot like what we have in this book. Describe the angel doll.
About exactly. She has, in the old days, we didn't have dolls the way we do now. I mean, all these Barbie dolls with their full figures and all this clothing and attire. I mean, dolls were very simple things then. And about the best you could, they had little wedding dolls. You know, you had a little bottle you could give them, and they would pour water in one end, and it would come out the other. But the biggest thing that the dolls in those, you know, the eyes always closed when you would put them down. But this is an old-fashioned doll of that sort. She's had her, you know, the regular little outfit, which is pretty well described here in the book of pink, and it was taken away, and a special gown was made for her, and then these wings and the halo, which is attaches by a little hook in the back of her.
Mrs. Barnes?
Mrs. Barnes
helps rig up the angel doll.
My friend Billy's mother. And Billy was he was my friend who got a Black Phantom bicycle on his. I was so proud of my bicycle that Christmas. It was
the Black Phantom was the big high end.
The ultimate fantasy for kids in those days. And I got a JC, a red JC Higgins from from the Sears and Roebuck catalog.
Hey, listen,
I was proud of it. I'll tell you,
I had one when I was a kid. Tell us about the role of a story like this that touches us so deeply in our emotions. How is this supposed to work in our culture?
I think there's a great longing in our society for simpler times and for more innocent times. Uh-huh. And there is always this book. The theme of this book is the greatest theme of all, and that's the theme of love. We all seek it in one way or another, and you know it takes many forms. In this case, it's the love of a of a boy for his little sister.
Right.
So I think there's an immense need for goodness. It bothers me when I see the attitude that I see, for example, in New York, you know, amongst publishers and whatnot. Yeah. We have become a society that is so caught up in competition,
right,
and so caught up in stylishness and in faddishness and in cynicism, you know, that it almost makes you wonder if there's any valid reason to go on. So when I see these little stories, and this is a redeeming story, this is a story that teaches us that love is a redeeming thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think that you've touched something worthwhile there.
All right, let's wrap it up here, Jerry Blood. So where is the Angel Doll today?
The Angel Doll today is right at this very moment in my wife's teddy bear room. But I travel with her when I do signings and whatnot, and she will be beneath our tree this Christmas as I hope she'll be from now on.
Jerry Bledsoe is the author of The Angel Doll, available from Down Home Books. Jerry Bledsoe's other books include the New York Times number one bestseller, Bitter Blood, as well as two other national bestsellers, Blood Games and Before He Wakes. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you where to write for an audio tape of this program. Listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were writers Lee Smith and Jerry Bledsoe. Audio tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Write to us for a tape or send us your comments. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 847. That's $10, program number 847. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Politics in the Information Age. My guests will be James Kinsella and Lawrence Grossman. James Kinsella was the founding editor of Time Warner's Pathfinder and was recently cited as one of the 20 most influential people on the World Wide Web. Lawrence Grossman was president of NBC News and also served as CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service. James Kinsella and Lawrence Grossman will be here to talk about politics and the power of the Internet. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. From all of us on the staff, the Board of Trustees, and the Fellowship Program of the National Humanities Center, season's greetings to you and yours. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.